be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hello, this is Rich Wexler from Vintage Annals Archive Outsider Podcast. Pleasure to be here. I'm Jewish, and I bring that up because it gives me the curse of the Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews is you get really bad allergies, and if you're lucky, you also get the irritable bowel syndrome. What a lovely combination to get through the day. Anyway, so I'm a little run down. I'm a little hoarse, but I'm happy to be here. Our guest today is one I couldn't be happier to have, Anna Biller. Been a fan of them since seeing Viva in the Philadelphia Film Fest many years ago. Fell in love with that film, with the costumes, everything in that movie. You know, there's not many things that are period pieces that get it really right, and she did that 100%. And then Love Witch, love that movie again visually. Remember reading articles years ago about, you know, shooting on film and how there was like one guy in the country who could actually like help, you know, do a certain part of it. And again, that's the kind of dedication and artistry that I think is in Anna's work. And then when I found out about her new book, Bluebeard's Castle, I really wanted to talk to her. I've been wanting to talk to her about her films for years, and this was a good opportunity. And again, this book really blew me away. It's a lot of Jane. There's a lot of Jane Eyre in there, a lot of other things, gothic horror. And what's amazing about it is once you know her films and know her as an artist, you can see, you get all that in the book, and you get to visualize it all. And it's, you know, for our liking and our page, you know, she's just the perfect person. Very, you know, again, such detail. Such dedication, such vision. I mean, honestly, she is an artist to watch. If you don't know her work, you should get it, because she's just going to get bigger and bigger. I'm a huge fan. So it's a pleasure. And then my editor and producer, Arthur Otter Castro. Ooh, this allergies get my brain clogged up. He co-hosted and helped me produce this, and he did an amazing job. Shout out to the park. So it's good to have him as part of this. So really enjoy, get a copy of this book. It's I don't know what it costs, but it's pretty reasonable, and it's really great. It's not a huge book. It's a pretty quick read and well worth getting, and I highly recommend it. So enjoy. Thank you. Anna.
Hello.
How are you? It's really good to see you.
Nice to see you too.
How's the tour go? How's the book tour been?
It's fine. Yeah, it's good. I had a great time in New York.
Nice. And how long is your book tour altogether?
That was basically it. It was like a week in New York.
Nice.
Then I had a few dates here, and I'll have a couple more, and then just like one thing in Portland.
I was curious on the process. I know this was gonna be a screenplay. And kind of how it landed on the book.
Well, I've been shopping around around Hollywood for several years, and I kept rewriting it. And I had set it up with a really good producer at one point, and somehow it fell through. I had so many meetings in Hollywood. I was really looking for a British producer. I thought I might find an American producer then that would team up with a British producer. So I did also meet with a lot of American producers and distributors. And, it just really wasn't working out. And then I found another British producer, and that was really great. And I thought that was going to happen. And then we met right before the pandemic hit, and right before everything shut down. You know, and then, you know, his company, which had just started, it was a new company, that shut down.
Oh, no.
So I didn't know what to do, you know. So I wrote another, I worked on some screenplay, a spec job on a screenplay. I'm never doing that again. I was rewriting somebody's, doing a spec rewrite of somebody else's screenplay for Warner Brothers. And it's because they said they wanted me to direct it.
Okay.
And so I needed to have it rewritten. And so I just did it I spent weeks, they hated my rewrite, and they decided, yeah, you know, it's just like, it was just all this, it was a waste of my time. And then I realized, like, I'm actually really good at adapting and rewriting other people's stories, you know, that I'm actually, I have a real, actually my version of that screenplay was fantastic. It was so dumb to not make it into a movie. But I thought, I want to, let me adapt something. So I was looking for something to adapt. So I was looking, you know, I love these Japanese ghost movies like Kwaidan, Kuroneko, Ugetsu. I just think they're so fantastic. And I thought, that's what I want to adapt. I want to adapt a Japanese ghost story. So then I wrote that screenplay. I found a really famous Japanese ghost story to adapt and set it in medieval England. And I shopped that around for a little bit. It seemed like everybody in Hollywood was so like disheartened and low energy. And I don't know, it just was not a good time to shop something around. So anyway, my boyfriend one day suggested to me that I write a novel because my agent was sending a bunch of books that I didn't like. I didn't think they were good books. I didn't think they were well written. They were, you know, all these books they wanted to make into movies. And he said, well, why don't you write your own book? And then you can make that into a movie. I said, I only want to do the Bluebeard movie, really. And he said, well, write that as a book. I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write that as a book. So the next day, remember that was 4th of July. And the next day I sat down and I wrote it. You know, wrote 1,000 words per day till it was done. And then I did two more drafts. And then the day that I finished my second draft, I wrote on Twitter, I just finished my novel today. And then the fiction editor for Verso wrote me on my website and said I'd love to read it. And they ended up buying it. So that was kind of insane in a way, because I didn't think Verso would like it. They're a radical left, mostly nonfiction publishing house that I respected a lot. I had some of their books. My boyfriend had a lot of their books. You know, they published like Marx and Engels and
and your book.
Adorno and my book, yeah. So you know, I just didn't, it didn't seem like a match, and I, you know, I thought they would think it was, you know, not good. So I sent it out to a bunch of agents. I did this whole agent query thing, and got all this like negative feedback and rejection. And somebody, you know, they gave it to beta readers who hated it, and you know, I got all, and you know, it's not viable for the publishing world. So I got all that feedback, and then the editor came back to me, said that they loved it, and so that was like, so just to point out that I did get all, I did have the horrible. I didn't just have, you know, like, oh, you know, he wrote me and they put, you know, I did like put myself through all this agony between the time I gave it to him, but the time he loved it. He told me he loved it after about a month, but then like he had to like run it by his colleagues. And I was terrified that his colleagues would think it was terrible, especially since these beta readers had read it and rejected it. So I wanted to do another rewrite. So I made him wait like 2 months. I did another rewrite. And then he showed that to his colleagues, and you know, and then it was accepted.
How different is it in your head to write a screenplay versus a book? Does it feel, because this felt, I mean, even reading it, it felt like it read like a film.
Very cinematic for sure.
Well, I did do it in the exact order of the scenes in the screenplay. And I did describe, you know, the sets and costumes and everything. But, you know, it's a psychological novel though, which a film isn't. You know, that's the thing. That's what you don't get in a film. You don't get the character psychology. And this is so stuffed with psychology. But it's also, if you look at the language is not, it's not like screenplay language, you know? The language is literary. And so like, I had to put that, see, that's why I had to keep doing more and more drafts. I was looking for the language to make it into a real sort of like a quote unquote real novel. I wanted it to be a real piece of fiction, a real piece of literature. And so I didn't want it to be like a film. I wanted it to be like a book. Well, I had to really work on that a lot, you know, from my first draft to my 10th draft, or how many drafts I had. You know, most of that was working on the language, because I had the character as a structure. Like, I had all that from the screenplay that was already sound. It was really just like writing it out in a way that felt like a novel. That was like what the challenge was.
It's, I mean, from just from learning a little about you, from watching Viva, from Love, which it seems you also have a love for musical theater.
Yeah.
And yeah. And was that part of your experience in theater?
Well, you know, where this all comes from is like my mom is a huge fan of classical, old, you know, classic movies and musicals. And I grew up watching like the Astaire and Rogers movies and the Berkeley movies. And I grew up watching all those musicals. And she was a fashion designer, and she took her inspiration from the old movies. She was designing clothes that were a little bit riffing on those 30s costumes for her shop, you know, and she just, you know, she had this really popular store in West Hollywood that she ran with two gay guys. And I guess they had antique clothes, and then she had her clothes that she made, and it was a big hit with, you know, and it was funny, you know, so I grew up watching her, but she just like constantly had those movies on all the time. And so I grew up watching those movies, and that was really, I was doing like three things. I was watching those movies, watching old movies. I was reading a lot, like bookworm, like a really, really intense bookworm with no friends. And then I was looking at art books and drawing. So like my dad was an artist, a painter, and we went to all the art openings and museums. So that was my childhood, basically. I was very much a loner. I was very shy, and I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid. That was the thing, because I read so much. I did so much reading. Yeah. So I was a weird kid too, because when they put on new movies, I would leave the room and I'd go read a book, because I only liked the old movies. And this is starting when I was like 5 years old. Because I thought they were like beautiful. They were like a dream. You know, they were like mythic, you know, and that's everything, like the newer stuff is so vulgar and repulsive. I thought it was so violent and ugly and so misogynistic. I didn't know the word misogyny till I was probably 20, but whatever that feeling it gave me, bad feeling.
And I mean, it's a tricky conversation to talk about feminism from a male perspective, which I'm not going to do, but it seems like you have really owned your own version of feminism in all this work, which is amazing. And when I hear men talk about feminism, I think of like horrible hippies. I think about the character in Aviva with the guitar.
Oh, you know, they talk the talk, but they're just like con artists and seducers, basically.
So I guess I'm curious on where your feminism comes from in terms of books, in terms of films, and where you feel like your strengths are within that. I mean, it seems like, you know, a lot of the reviews of the book talk about this being a feminist novel. How do you feel about that? Is that something that you agree with, or?
Well, when people talk about feminism, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because they call all kinds of things feminist that are not feminist at all. And they talk a lot, they call a lot of things made by men feminist when they're actually like not at all intending to be feminist. They would like hate to be called that. You know, I've heard people call like Dario Argento a feminist. You know what I mean? And it's just ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? It's like, or like Lucio Fulci or something. And you're like, okay, whatever. What do you mean by that? They don't know what they mean by it. What they mean is that there's women in it, you know, and they're like a character. The woman has lines. And, you know, the thing is like, there are people who actually look at my work and they say it's feminist because there's women who get to be sexy. And that's not feminist. I don't find that feminist. It's insulting to me the way people use the word feminism, they throw it around. My work is feminist, but not for
the reasons they think.
Yeah. The reason it's feminist is because I made a decision when I was in art school at CalArts, when we were reading all these feminist texts about the kind of films I wanted to make. And I made it was a conscious, clear decision about what is, you know, and it was really based on, you know, Laura Mulvey's essay, Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema, I think it's called. Anyway, you know, so that essay, you know, and it was talking about how in cinema, visual pleasures is for men. And I actually kind of agreed with her and disagreed. But what was interesting is it started this cascade of ideas in my mind about cinema, like what it was. And it sort of like made me understand why I like classic cinema. Because in my view, there was a great deal of visual pleasure in narrative cinema for women up until a certain point in history, and then it ended. And that was why I was unable to watch period cinema, mostly unable to watch cinema made after the period in which the women's point of view disappeared.
What years do you put that at? What films or what years kind of started the...
Well, no, it's sort of like it was women's cinema. Classic cinema was great for women up until sometime in the 60s. And then it's very obvious the way it fell off. Like if you really look at a lot of films like before and after, like you look at films from the 30s and 40s and 50s, and you look at films from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and you look at you could just take a whole bunch of the most popular films from one era and then from the other, and you can really see the difference. It's very stark, it's very dramatic. So one thing is they stopped giving women like good roles, like important roles. And, and then they also, the roles that women got were not, so even the actresses at the time complained about it. You know, like for example, Kim Novak, I think it was when she was at Columbia, and I think it was Harry Kahn died, and the roles they were giving her were just so insulting. They were just like, bikini beach bimbo, like she got no good roles anymore. You know, Joan Crawford is in the 70s giving interviews about how they stopped making movies with female stars, stopped making roles for women. Everything was written for men, and also movies moved from the inside to the outside. So it's like we had these great interiors, these great interior decorators, these great female stars, their gowns. And then suddenly we're outside, we're in the old West. You know, there's no women anymore. You know, it's all men. It's all men. It's war. It's Westerns. Also, you know, movies started to be about things like men's midlife crisis. And then, you know, there's a sexual revolution. But, you know, the other thing that changed it was hardcore pornography. Because then it's just like people stopped wanting to watch any movies with women in them. Unless those women were having like hardcore sex or something. And so we had the porn thing, and then it really ended, because I think it's like in the early 70s and late 60s, you had like Bradley Metzger, and then he changed his name to Henry Paris, and he started making hardcore films. He was making softcore films that were for the whole family. They were kind of like, and you know, originally like the hardcore films were supposed to be mainstream for couples, etc. But very, very quickly, within a year or two, it just became, that was a market for men. You know, and then all the sexuality, there was this like fun sexuality that women had all through the classic period. And then suddenly women didn't have sexuality in films anymore. It was all male sexuality. And it was all about male sexuality, male desire. And women were just objects. And it was very brutal in a way. And I think it's, you know, it corresponds with the women's movement, with hardcore pornography, all these things. But so Laura Mulvey's essay was about, you know, she was writing it right, you know, after that shift happened and when movies stopped being for women. And I thought about her challenge about creating a visual pleasure in narrative cinema for women. And I thought, well, that's really easy to do. All you have to do is go back in time, redo the classic movies, but do them for now, like do them with the modern, you know, do them, you know, my experience through like filtered through like, let's say a pre-code movie or like a noir movie or something. That's for women. That's great for women, because, you know, a lot of those old movies were written by women.
Right.
They were from books by women. Not too many female directors, but you know, there were movies made for the whole family. So like,
yeah.
these female protagonists were so great. Like men would watch them, women, everyone in the family would watch them and get into them. They were the biggest movies. They weren't relegated to like chick flicks or just some dumb, you know, like niche thing. You know, All About Eve is basically like a classic women's picture. It's also like a major Academy Award winner. It's also one of the best classic films ever made. You know what I'm saying? And it's just like, it's these, and the female stars were bigger than the male stars. It was just a period of great, you know, and that comes from opera, you know, and it comes from you know, the great divas of opera, then you had the great divas of silent films and the great divas. But that whole concept of the diva just was, it was like, it was also the hippie movement, you know, like the whole concept of like glamour was smashed under heel with the hippie movement. It was like the wealth, glamour, you know, femininity was kind of like stood for like phoniness. It's like men with dirt on their grime on their faces, right? Outside with their horse. That's like, oh, that's new Hollywood, you know? And then femininity is like, it's like makeup, it's phony lighting, it's sets. And it's like, all the filmmakers were indoctrinated into this new Hollywood. It's like new Hollywood, femininity is stupid, sets are stupid, lighting is stupid. So like me doing this is not just about like, you know, just someone who likes theatricality. There's a political statement here, and there's a reason why I'm trying to not only go back to like filming women and as main characters, but also just bringing back like everything that disappeared along with the classic era, which was like the lighting, you know, the cinematography, the color palettes, the artistry of interior cinematography. And because it's like, and you know, like when I was in school, I was also reading about Eisenstein. I was reading like his film form, film sense, and his books that were about, you know, it's kind of like everyone was terrified. You know how everyone was terrified when you added sound and it was gonna kill the artistry because it's gonna be too realistic. And then people are terrified when you brought in color, it's gonna kill the artistry. But you know, like Eisenstein was talking about this stuff about color, like if you're gonna use color, you know, he had all these like theories about color, like this is what yellow means, this is what blue means. And that's how people were making films, you know, at the beginning of like the Technicolor era, they were thinking about color symbolism. And I think like, if you're gonna like make really effective color films, that's the way to do it. Because otherwise it is too realistic. It is just kind of, gets to be just kind of like noise, or it gets just to be like a mirror, or it gets to be, you lose a point of view. So, you know, so I'm just like very, very classical in my thinking about filmmaking. So this is why I get so irritated when people say, well, your films are just like Russ Meyer, because, you know, Russ Meyer was, you know, he was a pornographer, right? So he's a precursor of the hardcore movement, and he did some hardcore type films. And so he was like doing that. He was on that other line of filmmaking, that branch that was going to lead to just the complete destruction of women in cinema. No, I mean, what I'm doing is I'm taking from cinema that's before Russ. He was after things were already ruined for women. I'm taking from a cinema that's before that. And it's sort of like, if people can't see that, that really frustrates me.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if I can ask you, and again, I don't know if I'm hoping I'm not doing this while I'm talking to you. I'm just questioning, but I'm curious on, if you look at that time frame you're talking about, it seems like you've landed on horror, and I'm curious if horror allows either your message to get, I'm curious what it is about horror, if anything, from films before or even now, and why horror works for you within this world you're creating.
Because it's something, because it's a genre you can sell right now. That's the only reason. Because I want to continue to make movies. I want to get them financed. So that's a simple reason. So for example, like, okay, so when I was making short films, I had a lot of people making, I made this movie called A Visit from the Incubus, which I thought was a very good short film. And it was,
I love that movie. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, as a matter of fact, I feel like both A Visit from the Incubus and The Hypnotist had a lot of imagery and storyline that I felt interpreted fully in this book. And it was really nice to see a lot of those sort of storylines flesh out a little deeper as far as allegories and as far as story. I did see a lot of similarities between those two movies in this book, and it was really nice to see.
What book?
The Bluebeard.
Oh, the Bluebeard book. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm sorry.
Like, I had a really hard time getting those screened, those films screened, especially The Incubus. I couldn't get it screened anywhere. And, you know, it was such a sort of a technical feat, I thought, you know, what went into like the design and the acting and everything in those movies. And I asked for some feedback. Like, this was this guy who was programming shorts at the Egyptian Theater. here in Los Angeles, and I wanted his feedback as to why he wouldn't program it. And he wrote me this letter about how it insults the intelligence of his audience, because we've seen it all before. And I was thinking, what does he mean by that? And also, he said it was like, you know, for the whole family. It was so prudish. There's no nudity. So, you know, so I thought about that, you know, and I thought, well, what does he mean? It insults his audience. Well, what he means is that it's overtly feminist. That's what he means by insults the intelligence of his audience. What does he mean? It's fun for the whole family. He means that my character Lucy didn't get naked. Okay. So, and I've heard from other programmers. The other programmers made fun of me.
Oh shit! I'm really sorry you had to go through all this.
That's a shame.
About it's being prudish because, like, you know, high neck gowns, whatever. And the thing is, I thought about this. I thought about how I wasn't going to I wasn't going to be able to get screened, even doing. So this concept I had about going back to like earlier styles of filmmaking, I thought I'm going to have to update this a little bit in order to get screened. So the very latest I can update it and still tolerate the style would be like the early 70s, like 1972. That'd be the latest, because right after that, it's when we went to earth tones. You know what I mean? So 72 still feels like the 60s. It's the very height of the sexual revolution. It's the year when the most Playboy magazines were sold. I thought, I'm going to do a movie. So my friend Jared and I, who plays Mark in Viva, who also plays the Incubus, we're really good friends. We were.
I got to say, I love him. I didn't realize he was in Viva twice, but he is a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, and he's good. Yeah. So anyway, he's a good friend of mine. So we were having lunch in Burbank, and then we went by this store that sold a bunch of used magazines of stuff. We used to use magazines, and I hadn't really seen those old Playboys for many years, those vintage ones. And I was, you know, they had all of them, and I was looking through, I was absolutely amazed. I couldn't remember how sexist they were, and how overt and how garish the sexism was, and how weird it was. And I got kind of excited. So then I decided, yeah, I think I'm gonna make a movie based on these magazines. So I like bought every copy from 71 and 72. And some from 70, and I took them all home in a big bag, and I tore out the images that were the most interesting to me, and I laid them out all on my floor, and I made a story out of them. I like treated them like storyboards. So there was like, you know, the scene with the madam and her two prostitutes and filmy negligees. There's a scene of the boss chasing the secretary around the desk. There's a scene of the young nudist hippies growing pot, and the old guys walk by, and they say it's nice to see youngsters taking an interest in nature again. there's everything. Every scene is based on like some ad or cartoon from Playboy magazine. There was one for Book of the Month Club from Playboy, and there was a man sitting like in a red shirt, and he was just sitting there with no pants on, and his wife was coming over the hill bringing him some like whiskey. And, you know, so like every scene, you know, it's like the scenes are so weird in Viva, but they all come from something, you know.
I'm trying to be a little more creative with my approaches to research, and I made a list of the cringiest scenes from 1 to 10 in Viva. And I'm curious, as having acted in, what was the scene that felt the worst? What was the scene that you were in that felt kind of maybe or just that felt tricky? I don't know, maybe
I was like,
it's
I was having fun. I don't know. I was just being weird.
Okay.
I just wanted to see. So I thought, okay, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna do this. It's gonna have lots of sex and nudity, and it's gonna be like really it's gonna be more modern, in a more modern period. And it's not going to be feminist. And now I want to see what people say. It was like a little bit like I was being kind of puckish, right? So it was like, you know that movie Bedazzled?
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't describe what he wants accurately enough, and then he gets what he doesn't want. That's what I was trying to do. I thought, okay, so they said they want something with sex and nudity, and they want this and that. I'm going to give them that. But underneath, and it's not going to be feminism, but underneath, it's still kind of like a radical feminist work underneath, but in, like, nowhere on the surface, so they can have what they think they want. And I was just kind of like punking all the programmers by doing this. And it's like, okay, so I did. I got on the map. I got screened all over the world. I became notorious. So there you go. But see, like, you can't necessarily 100% say that I chose to do this style of movie. I was trying to do something that so I could actually get seen. And so it was the same thing with horror. It was kind of like, okay, what? And the other thing is, people really saw my films as cult films, and it seemed like they really wanted a cult film, like, really badly. So I was like, okay, I'll make a cult film and have sex and nudity. You know, it'll be really, 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 really tasteless, really outrageous. You know, I'll just do, you know, I mean, so I did it, you know, and it was, you know, whatever, you know, I was actually truly trying to please my whatever prospective fans, audience. So, but I'm trying to get closer to what I really want to do, right? So The Love Witch was, see, at The Love Witch, I snuck in all those Victorian gowns again, see? So this is like, because it's like, it sort of is referencing Hammer Horror in a way. And so I got, so yes. So there you go. So if you do Hammer Horror, then you can have all those Victorian gowns. It's like, I had very little nudity in The Love Witch, but because the actress is so beautiful, even if she's not even really nude, then it's enough. It was enough. So I get the Victorian gowns. And the thing is, what's interesting is there is some nudity. There are some nude scenes, but you know what? Like the memes that are shared all over the internet, they're not the nude scenes. They're the ones with her and the long sleeves and the high necks and the jewelry, because I made those more erotic. I made those more interesting, and I made them more visual than the nude scenes. And so that's it. So see, that's a triumph for me. See, that's an act of
film. It's a beautiful film. And I love that you made everything, which is such, shows your dedication and love. I know you did it. You did it for function, but it's amazing that's all you.
I had to do it. I made lists. You know, it's like, what needs to be done? Just do it. But the thing is, like, but you see how that's. So you're asking me about feminism. To me, that's a radical act of feminism to have a movie that has so much nudity in it that actually the nudity is less interesting than the costume.
It's secondary.
Secondary to the costumes and somewhat not even noticed. So the thing is like, and also my fans. For Viva, I go to a screening of Viva. It was mainly men who are fans of Playboy and Rosemont, etc. I go to these book signings now, and they're all my Love Witch fans. It's 90% women, young women. And so my audience changed. And so, like, even though I have all this nudity in the Love Witch, the men don't care for it as much as the women, not at all. And it's like a lot of sweet gay boys, too. And it's like, you know, trans women. And it's like really nice. I love that. And it's kind of like I think it's partly also my activism on Twitter, because I'm kind of vocal on Twitter, and a lot of people want me to shut up and have told me, they ganged up on me in the thousands occasionally. Yeah, I got some all-ons telling me to shut up. But I think it's like, it's, you know, but the thing is like, I'm doing what most women don't do, which is I'm kind of just doing what I want to do without like terror of doing it. Like, it's like I do care, but it's strategic what I'm doing. You see what I'm saying? I'm trying to speak to a certain type of experience that I have in the world, and I'm assuming that if I have it, other people have it too. But you know, other women have it too. Like this experience of being a woman, which is just surreal, which is what The Love Witch is about. It's about the surrealism of being caught in all these like impossible places socially, where you have nowhere to go. There's nowhere to navigate. And so if we're going to segue to the novel, that's what my novel is about too.
Absolutely.
Does this, and I hope I'm not insulting you, but does this feel like subversion to you in some way?
What do you mean? Is what?
I mean, if I look at The Love Witch, if I look at your, there's a lot of commenting on how men are just crybabies, and I love it for that reason. There's a lot of, you know, especially in, I think in Viva and also in The Love Witch, where, you know, the men are seen as feminine.
No, they're not. They're not seen as feminine. No, they're not. No, they're not. They're not feminized. No, them crying, let me just correct you. Them crying has, they're not feminized. The reason they're crying is not because they're feminized. They're crying because they're power hungry and they're not getting their way.
Right. And I didn't mean to say like that. My apology. I love that you were showing how men will act like that, yet want to be masculine every other moment. You know what I mean?
Well, here's the thing. This isn't me like making this up out of the ether. This
no,
is
no,
like,
no.
I've been in relationships with men, right? So here's the thing. It's like you're in intimate relationships with men. You see all the sides of men. You see all these different sides of men. And so like most of the movies, the books that we have are made by men. And we get to see men like putting like a magnifying glass on all the different moods of women that are good and bad. And especially in the more modern era, you know, like nightmare girlfriends or women are hysterical or women are this or they're manipulative or they scream or they cry. Well, you know, men do all of that too and under pressure.
Right.
We don't see it very much because men are not showing that side of themselves or the side of men. So it's just, it's kind of like it's, I'm just basing it on like my experience. So like if you're a woman, your experience of men isn't going to be that they're just so great all the time and they're just always like winning and they're so dignified and they're so fantastic and they're just so like a boss in every aspect of their life. I mean, you don't see that. You don't see it. You know what I mean? You see like, you know, you see them whining and you see them weak and you see them crying and you see them angry and you see them being like a pig or whatever. And they're also nice sometimes. They're also really nice and wonderful sometimes, but you just like, it's a gamut. It's a range of like what human beings are like. But I'm also trying to show that about the women. I'm not like saying the women are perfect, you know, like.
No. And I absolutely love the way you do that in this novel. It encapsulates both the fantasy elements, but a lot of the truth of male and female relationships and not just the female gaze or the male gaze, but also the chink in the armor that goes with those fantasies and how the dynamics that the politics of sex that come out in those relationships, especially as the courting process continues from start to finish. You get a lot of these in that book. And I love the way you explore that.
Thank you. Yeah. So the thing is, it is actually just realism what I'm doing, you know, bitch. I mean, it's just really like what I'm doing is realism, but it's hidden behind the trappings of genre or convention. And so this is where, this is where Viva is so different than let's say Russ Meyer or like some sex comedy, because it's really more like some like very serious drama. And then
right.
That's like some sex comedy overlaid over it, you know, and the same thing with like a book, Bluebeard's Castle, is a very serious domestic drama tragedy, if
absolutely.
You will. And then with this kind of like fun gothic trappings, so they put it like a fantasy, like a layer of fantasy on top of it. So originally it was almost like a cinematic fantasy. And then when I wrote it as a novel, I tried to turn it into like almost like a Bronte type of situation, which is why I spent so long on the language to try to make refine the language. So I was reading only 19th century Gothic novels when I wrote it, so that I would really get into that, or 18th century even, like Anne Radcliffe.
I'd taken a course in college, it was a feminist course in literature, and all the books were male monsters and Jane Eyre and Watch Your Gas with C, and all the books that we referenced, I saw played out somewhere in Bluebeard's Castle. There's a lot of seemingly references to Dracula through that.
Dracula, Frankenstein.
SOC,
Jane Eyre.
Yeah, and I loved that was in it. And it just, you know, men are narcissists. Are you seeing that overall? Are you seeing that? I mean, it seems like the main character seems to be playing with narcissism.
I have two male characters, and one of them is very compassionate and kind, and the other is
Tony.
And the other man is a monster of narcissism. So I'm not sort of painting all men with this kind of brush.
No, and by having these two very different male characters, it offers us a very, very strong dynamic, almost of the separation of a male personality and the different aspects, the light and the dark of both worlds, the light and the shadow, and to utilize that as these two sort of comparative elements in our protagonist's life, it really does show how both worlds work in the real world. And I found that the fantasy elements of the book are very, very different than the horror elements of the book, which tend to be the more truer, the real world that we live in. A lot of the escapism is the fantasy, and a lot of the horror elements are very true to real life, which makes the book that much more terrifying.
Yeah, the fantasy elements are mainly just in her own mind, actually. They're like in her fantasy life. It's like what she thinks. It's like there's what she thinks her life is, as opposed to what her life really is.
Yeah.
And her fantasy life is not realistic. It's based on books, basically, and fantasies. It's just not based on. And then, you know, she doesn't want to know who he really is. She wants to stay in the fantasy world.
Yeah, and a lot of the writing does come off as not only from the Gothic period, but there is very much the Romantic period of writing in there as well. And
yeah.
And I love the way that you were able to dabble in both of those worlds. They are compared a lot, but they are different. And and the way you were able to balance the literary techniques of both was really brilliant.
When you say the Romantic period, do you mean like the late 19th century or the?
Correct.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm curious on if you're comfortable talking about this. What if you didn't have to worry about all this stuff? What would you be making if you didn't have to worry about money? You don't have to worry about these. It seems like you went through a lot of shit from a lot of horrible people and doing all this, which is very admirable that you kept going because not everybody can go through that. And I'm just curious on if you had your own choice, what would you be making? I know it's kind of a silly question because it's not.
It's kind of irrelevant in a way because I'm kind of like, the next movie is exactly what I want to be doing, you know? Like, I do exactly. Because the thing is I said, like, okay, so I'm getting into horror because that's what you can make right now. But then I get really absorbed into it and I find a way to make it exactly what, you know what I'm saying? So I don't know what I would have done like years ago. Like my first feature would have been, if I could have done anything I wanted, it probably would have been a musical. But see, I've gone away from that now. No, I've gone away from that now. You know, I've gone into sort of a darker space, which I think is good for me, actually.
I don't want to get too much into it, but you mentioned kind of just this is a lot of this work is you kind of getting, you know, dealing with trauma. How much have you been empowered, or how much has this been a healing process? I don't want to, I'm not asking you your direct trauma. I'm just curious on.
Oh, every movie heals me. You know, I'm telling you, every single movie has healed something very, very. You know, this book has been even more healing than anything else so far.
In what ways, if I can ask?
I think there's more words in it. Like there's more themes, there's more stuff I get to talk about. So there's more stuff I get to work through.
Yeah. What was the personal challenge in writing this? Well, I'm curious on the challenges of just writing this versus, I mean, just the challenges of writing it. I'll keep it simple.
I just really loved writing it. I loved writing. I'm a very natural writer, I realized. But you know, the thing is, what was interesting is that I think the reason it was easy for me was because I learned to be a really good editor because I've edited all my films. And so right. I edit very, very precise when I edit. Like, you know, I know exactly what I want. Like, what I want this performance and I want that. You know, I want that. I want this clip to be this long. You know, so I guess what it is when I'm editing is I'm feeling the emotions that I'm trying to feel it like as a spectator, like how, like I'm watching this. How do I feel? What do I want next? What do I want to see right now? What do I want to feel right now? And that's also how, when I put music to things or I write music, it's like, how do I want to feel? And if I'm not feeling the right emotion, then something is wrong with the editing. It's wrong. Something's wrong with the scene. I want to feel a certain way. I don't want to pull. And if I'm not, you know, and if I'm not feeling that way and I can't get it, then I'll reshoot. I'll reshoot stuff to get the feeling right. Like I had to reshoot the ending of The Love Witch. The ending, I couldn't get it to feel right. So I had to reshoot it. But the thing is, like, the same with the book. So when I'm writing it and then I'm editing it, it's like, I don't want to feel right now. Like, if I feel like the slightest bit of distraction, like bored, if my eyes start closing, get sleepy, then that the passage is too long, you know? If I, you know what I mean? It's like, kind of like, if I, you know what I'm saying? I want to be pulled through it emotionally, like the reader. And I just, so when I'm editing, I think I'm good at that. I'm good at like knowing what to fix, which is great because, you know, I can do it in film. I haven't been able to do it for art. You know, I went to art school all these years. And when I'm trying to like fix like a painting or drawing, I usually can't fix it. I just like try to fix it and it's like, I can't fix it. And I have to just draw something else because I don't have the skill. But in the writing, I always feel like, so like, I know exactly what to do. I know exactly what to do with this. So it's very satisfying because I can sit down and spend a few hours editing and I can get it done in the time, you know? And it's, so I don't know where that comes from. I think it just comes from doing so much reading, I think, in my childhood, but also I still read a lot and I do a lot of audiobooks. I think it's just like something about, maybe it's something to do with that. It feels more natural to me than anything else that I've done, except for maybe film editing.
And I think that makes me want to ask you is how much of you are in these characters
like a really a lot. Yeah. And so like, you know, I was reading a quote from some writer recently, something about like the most outlandish or the most fantastical books can be the ones that are the most autobiographical, you know, because then you're hiding it, you know, I'm thinly disguising it. What's interesting is that some of the people who have read this book, who are actually, I base some of the characters on a little bit, they don't know they're in the book. So that's how well I disguised it. I was terrified, you know, so certain people read the book, will they know? Terrified.
Are you the kind of person that also mixes different people into one character when you create characters, or not so much?
Not so much. I did tell my boyfriend that I based that trip on the honeymoon in Paris a little bit on when we first met. And we weren't in Paris, but it was a lot of things similar about like speaking French and all the kinds of finding all the similar interests. And he hadn't seen that when he read it. He didn't recognize it. And it was interesting because it was so much like how I felt when we first met. And it was like, see, that's my subjective experience of it, which.
He's also an author. Is there some healing there? Is it, was he a support in this process in some ways?
Well, he's always a support just in general, you know, just having him, you know. I mean, the fact that he told me, like, you should write this, that was, in fact, that was the biggest support, because what that says to me, see, I don't need very much encouragement because I've always been done everything on my own with very little help from anybody. So it's like somebody says you should write a novel, and if it's somebody like him, who's such a good writer, it's like he's saying he thinks that I can write a novel. I mean, the fact that he thought I could write a novel and it could be good and it could sell, he knew I could do it. That was just for me, that carried me through the process a lot. A lot of that just carried me through. He only read my first draft, the draft that I sent to the publisher. He only read one draft and his notes were great. And then I didn't have him read it after that. And he hasn't read the final book on it. He's just really busy. But yeah.
And I have to say, just, you know, I mean, to me, you're, when I saw Viva, it blew me away. Like I've been a huge fan since then, and watching Love Witch and reading this book, and your vision, I mean, your vision is amazing to me. How you do this, it's a shame. I feel like in some ways you're probably suffering from being too talented or unique in a certain way, because people don't understand it, because it's a different thing, and it's really, the vision is very clear in what it is. And I think people seem to get offended by that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I offend a lot of people by being unique, that's true. And I think a lot of people want to put me down for being unique, you know, but I also have a lot of, you know, I have a lot of fans too, but I think it's like, I don't know, like I'm not trying to be unique, so I think what's interesting is like, I'm trying so hard to just be normal. I'm just trying so hard to make like a movie, like how other people make a movie. And then this is what I come up with. And it's usually not only until a few years later if I revisit a work again that I haven't seen for a couple of years, and then I'll just look at it and go, this is bonkers. What is this? This is, and I don't see it as bonkers because I'm totally dead serious when I'm creating it. Like I'm really serious, like I'm really concentrating, and I'm really like dead, like this is what I want to say. And I'm just really involved and like doing it a certain way. And just really like have this intense energy towards it. And then later it's like, I see it from a distance sometimes as my work, my own work is really, really ridiculous. But yeah, I don't know, because I really don't see it that way when I'm making it, which is why I'm always really surprised when people are coming out. Like this book, I was so surprised when some of the early reviews called it campy. I was like,
called it campy?
Yeah, I was like, campy? Tragedy. Why is it campy? You know? Yeah, I was sad about it a little bit because I thought, well, now I'm doing a book, so they can't like point to some of the lighting and say that's campy because people, or the color. I've just got words here, and that's about my words are campy. It's like, wow, I'm never getting away from that. Like, I know, okay, I admit Viva was campy. I did it on purpose. But this book, I'm thinking, well, because it's kind of a simulacrum, this book of certain Gothic novels, like from the 19th century, maybe kitsch could be a word, but I don't think it's really kitsch, and it's not really homage either. I think it's more like I'm just trying to do a Gothic book. And I think like a lot of people write Gothic books now, neo-Gothic books. There's many, many, especially female writers who are writing lots of Gothic books. I've never heard a single one of them called campy. So I'm wondering whether it's just like, because I made Viva, I'm never leaving that down. Like,
I just, are you getting this mostly from more from men than females, I'm assuming?
Oh, no, it's everybody.
It's everybody. Huh.
They just like they don't want to think that I could do something else than what I already did. So like, so even like the Lovewitch, they called it campy, but that wasn't campy, you know? So it's kind of like, I did one really campy film. I was making fun of that whole Playboy thing. And then like, I've never been able to get away from that. And it's almost like, I feel like sometimes when people say like campy or they say restaurant, they're almost trying to say like, you'll never, never, ever escape, you know, being like a dirty girl who did Viva, who did nudity in Viva, or, you know, you're just that, you're pegged for life. You're like a dirty whore or whatever. You're not, just, no one can take you seriously. I'm not doing comedy, but I'm not doing comedy anymore. Like this is, you know?
Even if you don't, even if I were to watch these movies with no sound, the beauty you've created, the film, shooting on film. I remember reading an article about Lovewitch and how hard it was. I remember reading something about where like you had, there was only one guy in the country that could do.
Yeah, no, it was a negative cutting. Was a nightmare. I just like, you know what that like, you know, like I just saw a letter. I look at my Letterboxd reviews sometimes when you shouldn't, but I saw recently a Letterboxd review that said that the Lovewitch was like, everyone in the movie went to the Tommy Wiseau School of Acting. And
Oh, no. These people are being assholes.
I see people compare me to that movie all the time. A movie that was just incompetent and silly, you know, like The Room. So I just feel like, you know, like that happens all the time, you know. So people have these different, you know, I don't know. But I would love to be taken seriously for this novel. Like I wrote a book, and like it is like a new work, and it's not like I'm not like carrying the baggage around. I don't know.
I mean, except for certain themes, this book did not feel at all like the other pieces, except for certain themes. But this is, I mean, to me, this read like Jane Eyre in my estimation.
Thank you. That's what I was trying to do. Reading all those books, and I was really trying to make the language really really good, like good good language, and not just like cheesy like faux-oriented, you know. It wasn't a joke about writing or something.
Obviously, Viva has its own thing, but I feel like at least Lovewitch and this, they're serious works of art in my opinion. I don't see them. And I mean, again, you know, they appeal to me in so many ways. I mean, just the look, I mean, I could, the look of Lovewitch is just, I could freeze any shot and look at that for an hour. I'm a photographer, and like everything is beautiful as it is. And it's, I don't know. I feel it's a shame you've had to go through such bullshit because you're a very unique artist, in my opinion.
Well, a female artist is going to have a problem. In general. And I just also think, you know, I am I am making fun of men quite a bit. I mean, in my work, so that's, I don't see a lot of people doing that, to tell you the truth. I was actually looking for other novels that would actually go into like a BDSM scenario and actually talk about it as being a bit scary rather than it's just completely positive and wonderful. I really couldn't find a novel like that. I really looked. I mean, like, I think there's not, like, maybe there hasn't been a novel about BDSM that hasn't just been completely erotic and to titillate. Like, that just talked about the dangers of that, you know, and it's just, what about that? Because, you know, I think there's like, there's a lot of sexual things people do that can get kind of dark. And I think it's like that community doesn't allow any darkness to be written about it because it doesn't want the stigma. But like any types of sexual relation can be dark, but you know, it's weird, you know, it's kind of like, but there's like almost like a taboo element to talking about certain types of sexualities being dark, even especially the darkest kind.
Yeah. And the book does a good example of showing the dangers of putting enough trust in another person in those situations and feeling that I'm taking them at their value and not taking into account their ulterior motives. And it really does show the peril elements that can go into the darker side, especially when the fact that these sort of things are kept behind closed doors, that sort of power positions that can be escalated to the point where the person just becomes completely submissive and that sort of balance of the role dynamic is now thrown completely out the window.
Yeah.
I said one more question. I was curious, and I don't want to open a big topic, but I was curious in terms of you talking about how film shifted in a bad way and where it just kind of like where women's, you know, roles were horrible. Did you see, was the same thing happening in literature in your study over the years? Was the same thing happening with where women were getting shittier roles? Was that happening in literature or not as much?
No, it wasn't. That's interesting, isn't it?
What do you think makes a difference?
Well, because it takes so much money to make a movie, you need so much financing, and most of the financing companies are controlled by men and the producers and the studios and the everybody involved, and it's big money. It's money. It's a lot of money. Anybody can write a book. It's only your skill. It's all you need is skill. I mean, it's if you have a great amount of skill, then you can get published. Even if you get published by like an independent producer like me, your book can blow up. You know, even if you self-publish like E.L. James, your book can blow up, you know? So all you need is writing skill. There's no gatekeeping. So women are not left out of the process.
What's one of the better reactions, whether it's from someone reviewing it or from a fan, what's been some of the reactions that you really appreciated while after releasing the book? Like, what's been some good things?
Well, one woman who got an early review copy, who reviewed it for a magazine, I've been corresponding with her. I'd never met her, but corresponding with her for about 7 years. And she left her husband, her abusive husband, after reading my book.
Wow.
And she said that she started getting deprogrammed from watching The Love Witch. And then the book was what made her decide to finally leave.
I'm really appreciate you sharing that. It's really beautiful. Yeah.
There was another man who wrote a Goodreads review who said the book deprogrammed him to accept sexual violence from his partners.
I think all of us are kind of programmed to sometimes get caught up in the negative stuff. But to me, that's the value of all the work. And when you can change someone's life like that, that's not easy. And that to me is bigger than anybody giving you bullshit around it.
So what I said about there not being books that talk about these things that I could find, you know, somebody who reads a lot and who tries to stay up on everything, still most of what they're going to find when they're reading romantic literature about relationships is going to be that they're going to find in romantic books, they're going to find women staying with the most abusive men and working it out and finding love there. And that could really actually, like a book like 50 Shades of Grey could really convince somebody, this is the terrible violent man, to stay with that man, and they're gonna get the reward at the end. they'll be able to tame him. And so really my book really is also about romance novels. It's about that whole thing. Like even novels like Jane Eyre, you know, where she tames the madman and the wild beast, and he turns out to be mainly misunderstood, you know, and then she's got her prize at the end. But, you know, think about Rochester. You know, this is like one thing I ask readers to do in the book, is to think about Rochester a little bit. So I'm not doing the work of White Sargasso Sea as to really painting Rochester as a monster, but just there's a little bit of that, you know, the idea of like who would lock his wife in the attic, you know, and who would do that, right? And also, like, he does all these really other creepy things, like dresses as a female gypsy to trick her and gaslight. He does all these really horrible things. And then in the end, she can only really love him when the power dynamic has been equalized by him being blind and maimed, you know?
And I feel like there's a lot of compassion in your writing and your work, because you know, you are trying to point out that it's not one or the other. So this man is kind, this man is not. It's not one size fits all. And I think a lot of people maybe, you know, they want that. They want to believe this or that. People like to have, you know, black or white. But I love that you're presenting these two things at once and letting people kind of make their own decision within this span of different characters.
A lot of people get mad at my ending. The ending of my book is not the ending they want. And they especially get mad that I tack a moral onto it. But I think, like, if Perrault can make a moral, then I can make a moral. I'm doing another Bluebeard. He had two morals, both of which were horrible for his Bluebeard. You know, first one was, you know, that the women shouldn't stick their noses where they're not wanted. It's like her fault, you know, curiosity is evil. The second moral was, you know, this tale is very old. Men today aren't like that anymore. And today women really rule their husbands. So both of the morals were about sort of disavowing the real meaning of the fairy tale, you know. And these are folk tales. They're mainly oral tales that were passed down among women, you know, mothers and nurses and grandmothers for hundreds of years before these, you know, Grimm and Perrault and people wrote them down. And so he's actually coming in, he's the patriarchy coming in and saying, this is what this is really about. It's not about like a cautionary tale about marrying some evil man who might kill you. It's actually about how the woman is really terrible and snoopy. And she's Eve. She becomes Eve in Pandora. He makes her into Eve in Pandora rather than making Bluebeard into the villain. And I think we're still there. We're still there. That Bluebeard still is about Eve in Pandora. It's still about the woman transgressing her boundaries. And I still think, like, in all these horror movies they make now, you know, women, it's almost like they're justifiably murdered because they were stupid, because they had premarital sex, because they were bitchy, because they spoke out of line. And then, you know, the final girl is such an empowering figure. But, you know, okay, so if you obey all the patriarchal laws, you can live. Like, how is that empowering? Like, she's the one who obeyed all the commandments, you know, be virginal, you know, be androgynous, you know, be sweet, you know, don't, you know, be strong like a man, be like a man, basically, and then you can survive.
And some of those messages are really horrible. I feel like every, you know, I remember watching something, and it was like, it was a documentary. It was like every time a woman had sex, and especially in the 80s movies, they were murdered right after.
And it was like, exactly. That was. And what that says to a woman is, oh, you know, be a good girl or this can happen to you, right? You know? If you have sex outside of marriage, if you disobey, you know, the rules of propriety around premarital sex, or, you know, this can happen to you.
And what really throws me off, especially now with culture, is like, how the fuck are we back here? How have we?
Well, patriarchy is really old. I mean, it's really old. I'm rereading the Iliad right now, and it's just like, I feel like, wow, 700 BC, we're still there. You know, it's like, it's like nothing's really changed, you know? So I was just thinking, like, all the power that men have, you know, that's all about Helen and this Briseis and all these women that they're swapping, they're having wars over. These women are just property, you know, and these kings are giving giving the soldiers, like, oh, you know, I'll give you 7 Trojan women, I'll give you 28, you know, maidens of whatever, you know, it's like they're just like pieces of silver, you know, women, you know, and it's just like, it's like, I think men, you know, they still want it like that. And a lot of men still think like that they can have it more or less like that. You just have to be sneakier. And I just think, like, why would men give up all their patriarchal power that they've had since the dawn of time? Why would they give it up? I mean, why? you know, so I'm a threat to people because I'm like making people think about this stuff. And there actually are really not that many feminist filmmakers out there. I mean, maybe the other ones are more like documentary filmmakers and that get smaller budgets than me or something. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, I still have small budgets, but I'm a little bit more mainstream than probably most actual filmmakers, which is a threat. Because you know, it's like every individual man has it in him if he wants to be like almost like a cop when it comes to, you know, maintaining the patriarchy. He'll do it in his personal life. He'll make sure that all the women in his circle feel like cowed down, like afraid of him. You know, his work, you know, people that work for him, his women, his wife, his daughter, whatever, sister. Everybody feels like he's the king. He'll make sure. And that's how individual men enforce patriarchy, even though it's not in the law. It's not enforced in the law. It's enforced through custom. And so when I have like, when I have like 2 million people see like a really innocuous tweet I made that has a slight feminist edge to it, and then I have like 6,000 men coming down on me on Twitter and making comments to try to disparage me for being an idiot. That's the power of the patriarchy to try to shut somebody down who's commenting on just a slight comment on some sexism in a poster that I saw. And it was just like a really mild comment. And I thought it would go by and then nobody would even see it. Because, you know, a lot of my tweets, like 30 people like it and then it goes away. I thought it'd be like that. But it was just like amazing what happened. You know, this stuff happens when you're, it's like, oh, here's a woman. You're stepping out of line and suddenly there's an army.
Well, and they're all, I feel like they're all like narcissistic bullies who just want to shut things down, but they're cowards. They wouldn't be doing it online if they actually weren't cowards. And
no, but I mean, this is a thing that men do online. They try to get women off of gaming. They try to get women out of their, what they consider as their male space. You know, I think if you're a woman, and you're talking about culture. Culture is a male space online. Like men want to police it. You know?
Yeah.
I fully agree. And I mean, elite, you know, I don't know. I mean, we try to make a difference here as much as we can. And we, you know, I don't know. I love that. Like right now we're a lot of the guests are speaking about feminism, and I love that I get to be part of that. Yeah. And thanks so much for being here. This is such a pleasure meeting you. And I'm really sorry you've gone through such bullshit, but I'm loving that you're here, and I'm really glad I got to talk to you, and I'm a huge fan. And I'm hoping we could, at least, you know, I don't know. I'd like to help make a very small difference if we can.
Thank you so much. And I just want to mention one more thing, because I don't know if I did mention it, but that medieval movie is being made.
Oh, beautiful.
I think I forgot to say that. So I did get a British producer.
Excellent.
And we're casting that now. Okay, so just so. It isn't like I just had to fall off of the film wagon and make another movie. So I just, you know, to leave you with that.
And please, it's anything you're working on, if we can help send it, I'm very, you know, I'm very happy to put whatever you're doing out there. We're going to push the book when we put this out. I got you. And it was really great meeting you. And I just can't wait to see what the next thing is. I guess everything you've done, it fits all my, I'm a big musical person. So all of it, the aesthetic, the film, everything being authentic. I mean, I love everything you're doing. I'm really sorry you've had to deal with so many assholes and such bullshit. I'm hoping we were not part of that.
Yeah, that's the nature of, and you know, the film business actually in general. It's not just personally me, but yeah.
It sucks. I'm sorry you got to deal with it.
Thank you guys so much. It was great talking to you both.
Thanks for being here. Thank you so much. You have a great night. Thanks so much for checking it out. I just want to say I'm really proud of where we're at in the podcast right about now. We've had some amazing female guests, and you know, it's hard to plan all these things, and we didn't necessarily plan all around. I got to interview Ileana Douglas right before this interview with Anna Biller, and when I found an episode that on a podcast, Ileana's podcast with them. And it was just, it felt like preparing for Ileana helped me prepare a lot for Anna's interview. And it's just great when that happens. And we also did an episode recently. It was Ashlita Bochamp, who basically talks about, was very inspired by a show called Minx to do a very like socially aware magazine with burlesque called Peekaboo. And I just feel like I'm very lucky to be talking to these amazing women about their work. I don't want to say I'm a feminist because I feel like, I don't know, when I hear men say that, I think about these creepy dudes in the 60s who are like, I'm a feminist, come sleep with me. So I don't, but I don't want to say that, but I do love that we kind of hit this stride right now where we've done like 6 or 7 interviews with amazing, powerful, intelligent females. And I love that that's kind of where we're at right now. That's all I want to say. Keep checking it out. We have a Patreon. If you want to donate, I don't get paid anything for this. I pay Otter, the editor and co-host. I don't get anything, which is fine. But it's helpful. I have a few bucks, you know, when you want to pay for ads and stuff. And please share the podcast. Instagram is our main audience. And when you try to do, when you try to do something that looks like an ad, Instagram kind of blocks it. And it's hard to even let people know we have this amazing podcast. We are on year 2. This is our 2nd episode. I couldn't be prouder. And again, just want to thank Otter Castro, who's does all the editing, does not earn what he should for it. And he's just a pleasure and so smart and knows all about this stuff. And it was great to kind of, again, interview with him. I think you'll see he did a great job. So until next week, enjoy and check out our if you're not a follower of Instagram, it's Vintage Annals Archive. Check out our webpage, vintageannalsarchive.com. It's amazing. It's got a video archive. It has photo archive. It has the Jewish Project. It's where we keep the minx. I did a whole like 16 episode on minx, which is an amazing show, which you can check out there. And then we have a Jewish Vintage Annals Archive project. It's on there. It's a lot of stuff. There's all these deep dives, 50 different ones of different things that we kind of highlight when we post that we give people resources to check out. So it's a pleasure. And I want to thank you. And also please, as long as you're not an asshole, please send me, we don't get a lot of feedback and I'd love some feedback. Again, non-asshole feedback. I've gotten a lot of asshole feedback, but I would like some, I just would like some feedback on what's going, I'm at a point where I realized in the beginning I wasn't listening as well as I could. I was doing too much research and I felt like I was trying to honor the people to a point where I wasn't listening as well. And I've really been working on simplifying some of the research. In the beginning I would do 14, 15 hours of research, which is great, but a little overkill. And then it's almost like I know too much and it's hard to just let the conversation go where it goes. And that's our goal. Our goal is always to really honor the guests, let them talk 90% of the time, and just, throw some questions in when I feel like I'm trying to, when I feel like there's something important to get to or to make a turn. I'm thinking a lot about improv, and I'm thinking about now when I try to listen to yes and. I don't want to cut people off, and I'm sure I have in the past, never on purpose, but I'm trying to kind of yes and. I'm taking what they're saying and I'm adding to it as opposed to shifting, and that's been a really good practice. So again, any feedback, any help, we really need people to share. We just, share about our page. We don't have podcasts are tough. We're competing against all these celebrities who can just pay for all this shit, and they're taking up a lot of the airwaves, and it's fine. They're great. I'm nothing against celebrities. I mean, half the actors can't work right now, so whatever they're doing to keep going, hey, I give a lot of props to. That's all. I'm going to stop rambling now, but enjoy. And again, we're going to go another year. After the 2nd year, I got to reevaluate if I have the time to do this. I'm teaching full time and I do a ton of photography. I get a lot of time off as a teacher, which is helpful, but I still got to do some stuff in photography and in this world while I'm teaching it. It's a little exhausting. So anything you can help with is great. Any help getting the word out, joining, becoming a patron, sharing about it is great. Thank you so much. Take care. We thought in different ways.